This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Game Time episode 29. My name is Jeff Sandhu and I'm alone today because Richard Bradbury is actually sitting outside at the moment playing Battlefield 1 They Shall Not Pass DLC. And we will be doing a review in just a moment. Richard will join me towards the later parts of the show. Right now he's just busy trying to, you know, fulfill his role of being a co-host, an excellent co-host on Game Time. Anyways, on the show today, I will be speaking to Justin Ng of Gatai Games, and they are the makers of a new VR game called Stifle, and we'll talk about it in just a moment. And then later on, I have Lydia Ho and also Peng Yiwei from Kurechi Studios, and they will be talking about Post Night. It is their latest mobile game that's available on iOS and also on Android phone. But first, as I mentioned, let's talk to Justin Ng of Gatai Games.
Hey, so I'm Justin Ng from Gatai Games. I'm 1/5 of the company and I'm the design business guy. So I help with design work and try to keep money in the bank. That's basically my job.
Before we talk about Stifle, which I actually managed to try for maybe, you know, a couple of minutes and thoroughly enjoyed it. Very, very creative game. Before we talk about Stifle, though, tell me a bit about Gatai Games. So how did all this come about? How did Gatai Games came about?
So basically, we started Gatai Games in, I want to say, June 2014. At that point in time, I think the industry has been going, like the game industry in Singapore has been around for quite a while. And when we started, it was like in this weird spot where there was a lot of like mobile game companies and not a lot of like original content stuff. So I think the reason for me and our co-founders, like me and my co-founders, to start a company was like we didn't want to work for like a big company, but to create our own original stuff. And that's like the main reason why we started the company.
And yeah. When was this? What year are we talking about?
June 2014. So it's been a while. Yeah.
Ellie, you started off building games for consoles immediately, or were you venture off into mobile games first? Because that's obviously another big market as well.
Yeah, so that's the funny story about Gatai Games. When we started, right, we weren't really sure what we wanted to do, like which platforms to target. But when we first started, we actually started with mobile games because we found like, we thought like there was a lot of money in mobile games, right? Like in 2014, it was like the mobile hype train where it's like there's games like Candy Crush and then there's games like Clash of Clans. Yeah, so those games are really big at that point in time, and to us, we were thought like, oh, maybe it's like we could ride the wave and be part of it. But unfortunately, like after about 3 to 6 months of working on mobile games, we kind of realized we didn't enjoy the process because it's, I mean, as much as I play mobile games once in a while, I feel like because when you do a mobile game, usually you give it away for free. And by giving away a mobile game for free, you're fundamentally changing the relationship between a developer and the gamer. It's like when you bring a PC and console game, I promise you an experience for a set price. Whereas with a mobile game, it's like, I'm going to give you the game for free and I'm going to try to get you addicted so I can make money off you. So that's kind of like the main things that kind of made us pivot towards PC and console.
Mm. And how much difference is it now that you're building games for PC and console? What's the biggest difference in the sense?
Between PC and console, if you're talking about PC versus, you're talking about PC versus mobile, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Well, I think the biggest problem is the kind of audience that we're trying to target, there's generally a bigger lack of funds in general, because like with mobile games there is no upper limit to the amount of profits you can get, right? Like publishers and like investors are a bit more interested in mobile games because they look at big titles like I mentioned previous like Clash of Clans and like Candy Crush, that there's no limit to the profit they can make in a sense. Whereas in PC games, the set price does turn a lot of people off, and it makes looking for money a bit harder from if you want to make games from this segment. But for us, like we enjoy the process a lot more, and
it's the passion that you have for, you know, making games for PCs and consoles, I guess, and also being able to tell, I guess, on PC and console, you are able to tell a better story in a game compared to a mobile.
I wouldn't say that because like, I know mobile games that tell good stories, but it's for me, it's really about the transaction model. Like, as from a PC developer standpoint, it's like, okay, we're going to charge this price. We're not going to hide anything behind a paywall. It's like, this is the game. It's like watching a movie, right? You pay us X amount and you get this experience and that's it. Whereas like in a mobile game, there's always this feeling that, okay, I'm getting this game for free. What's quote unquote lurking behind the paywall, right?
Yeah. Well, speaking of lurking, you have a game called yeah. Lurking. This was yes. a game developed over a course of 6 months in the DigiPen Institute of Technology in Singapore. It also won the Best Student Game and Excellence in Technology Awards in 2014. Tell me about Lurking, about the game. What is it about and how did the whole idea came about?
Okay, so Lurking plays a pretty pivotal role in Gartagrace as well. But I will just go through like what the game is about, then I kind of explain it. I'll kind of explain its role in Gartai Games. So we made Lurking as a school team back in we started the game in about 2013 September. We worked on it for about 6 months. It's a mind-enabled sound-based horror game. So imagine yourself as a blind person and you use sound to see where you're going. So like your footsteps create like a sound pulse that creates a temporary light bubble around you.
Wow.
If you throw an item, it kind of lights up a corner, or like you throw an item somewhere, the sound pulse creates that bubble as well, and that lets you see the world.
What's your inspiration from having a game that is very much driven on audio instead of the visual itself, which, yeah. you know, it's completely against what video games are, you know, very visual. Yeah. We always talk about all the graphics and stuff. We generally rarely talk about the sound element in games.
Yeah. So the inspiration from the game like stemmed from one of our game designers back then. His name was Dexter. So we basically saw this video of like this little girl finding her way around the world, like tapping on the walls, tapping on the ground to kind of figure out where she was. And she created like pulses that lit up her world. And based on her mood, right, what she saw was different. And from that video, like the team decided, like, hey, let's make a game around sound. And even though we say the game is very sound heavy, there's still a very big stylized visual element. So when we came with the art style, the sound director, Brian, was like, hey, like it's black and white, it's very graphical, it's very, when you don't make a sound, everything goes dark. It's perfect for a horror game. So as a team, that back then we just like decided, you know what, even though we haven't made a horror game before, we don't exactly know how to go about doing it. The game mechanic and the visual art style kind of like led us to it. So it's like quite serendipitous where we like just, hey, let's make a horror game. Yeah, and it did quite well, surprisingly. So
the success it had, it also was the nominee at the 2014 Tokyo Game Show, and also the Gamer's Voice nominee at the SXSW yeah. in 2015. And yeah. you're calling this, you know, it did okay.
I mean, like obviously it did well in award shows, but I feel like from a very international standpoint, I feel like a lot of people still don't know what the game is. Like it did get good hype. Like in Asia, people know. Like sometimes if I talk to people, it's like they don't actually know the game. So it's like, I feel like even though it did alright, it's not good enough. It's always this like, it's this very Asian thing. It's like, I feel like it can be better. I can always feel like it can be better kind of thing. Yeah.
And speaking of can be better, you've then released another new game, Stifled. It's the same kind of concept. It's your mic-enabled, sound-based, stealth thriller game. So tell me about Stifled. And is this like a part two of Lurking?
So this plays to the kind of like how, why Gartai pivoted to PC and console. Because like when as a team, there's like a bunch of people from the Lurking team actually started Gartai. And then when we saw Lurking started to gain some traction, it's like, hey, like I mean, we're not enjoying ourselves doing mobile, and then there's this thing that is doing quite well, like PewDiePie played it, Markiplier played it. It's like it's getting views and hits, and it's like, you know what, we should probably work on that. So it was like the seed for us to like, okay, let's just pivot to PC because like there's something that's sort of proven that we can just latch onto. And we brand Stifled not as a part two of Lurking, more like a spiritual successor. So what we mean by that is like conceptually it's the same game, but narrative, the art, the audio, the whole atmosphere, the world is different. And if people Google the games, you can see that the art style, even though it's similar, Stifled is a lot more like polished and yeah, it's overall I feel like it's a more solid game. Yeah. And it's not out yet. It's like we're looking at a mid-2017 release. Yeah.
Right. And what's unique about this is that I actually managed to get a glimpse of the game and it's actually VR enabled.
Yeah. So that's the additional thing we did with Stifled compared to Lurking. Because Lurking, when we started, the microphone actually part of it was like, oh, can we do VR cheaply? And because like headsets were really expensive, the microphone did kind of bring players into the game in like a very cheap and basic way. With Lurking, we actually tried doing a bit of VR, but I think we didn't do it very well. And with Stifle, it's like we decided like, hey, let's try to spend more time to make sure that we can transport players into a different world while making sure the game reacts to the player. So it's like on top of the microphone where players, where the world can react to the player's sound, we now trap the players in like a VR headset where it's like, oh, I look left and look right. It's like I can't look away from the screen, right? I'm just stuck there. And so we just make the experience a lot more intense, which generally speaking, based on our playtest and like going to events, the VR version does get a lot more screens, which is nice, I think. Yeah.
So you started off, doing games for mobile where, you know, you only probably could play around screens that are maybe as big as, 5.7 inches screen or, maybe a 6.5 inch screen on the iPhone 7 Plus and so forth. Now, though, you're doing games that are VR, which is a 360 degrees view of, reality in the sense. How much of a challenge is it in developing games that are VR-enabled?
I think the biggest challenge with VR is, like, it's a very new medium. People still don't fully understand how to, like, interact with the world and, like, feel comfortable. Because, like, if you play a PC game or, like, a mobile game, the idea of a screen and tapping away at it or, like, moving your mouse, it's very understandable. It's like people know how it works, right? But with VR, there's a lot of comfort issues that we need to take note of. So the biggest issue we usually get is like when your player's head is like moving around, and or let's say you are moving your player in the game in the controller, but your head is just like not matching up with that movement. It just like causes a lot of nausea, and people just like comment like, "Oh, I can't play this game." So.
And even if a VR game, I remember playing Stifle for a while and a few other VR games, and generally, for gamers, we tend to sort of maneuver our way around a VR world, and we sort of get it because it's meant to be like the reality. But I find myself telling people who are trying out VR for the first time, and they are, they are not gamers, and I always caught myself telling them, what would you do in real life? You do it in exactly like what we do in the game. It's kind of weird that we tend to sort of act differently in a virtual reality space when it's actually mimicking the reality at the moment.
Yeah, that's true. It's like people always feel like this, like they hate even when they put on a headset, right? Like they feel like, oh, it's something different. But actually, I feel after a while, people kind of like get into the space and be like, this is natural. This is like, yeah, it's a very weird thing. It takes a while to just get used to it and be like, just let yourself go in VR. Yeah.
And what's been the learning curve in terms of, the company itself and where it's heading in the direction now that you've also ventured into, the console side, and you're doing the VR, which is, like you mentioned, a very new medium in the gaming space. Where's the company sort of going, heading, directing to at the moment for Gatai Games? Are you, is console and, trying out new technologies, VR, AR, and all this kind of stuff, the direction that you're probably going to push forward?
I think for Gatai Games, we see the company not just about like games or like, I mean, games is definitely our main thing, which is probably our main thing forever. But we try to make games that we don't let like the technology like limit us. It's like we basically always is our core ideas is the games first. So if like we have a game idea that makes sense for mobile, we'll do a mobile game. That's fine. So like with Stifle, it's like we thought, hey, like the visual is different. We can transport players into a different world, which is why we led to doing VR. So for us, it's like we come up with core game ideas first that we think are interesting. And then from there, we decide which platform to go. So it's very fluid in that sense. And I think for us as a company, we always target international audiences. Yeah, it's like we treat our company as an international company. Like we build games, not just for Asia. We build games for the West, for the East, for everybody. Yeah. Mm.
So more importantly, then, when can we actually enjoy Stifled on our PlayStation VR?
I think this is something that I can't talk about in detail just yet, but definitely this year. The game is done. We're just like really at the end. We're at the end of the tunnel, right? It's like we see the light. We're just like finishing up, making sure that it's done and all that. So probably mid this year.
All right. Yeah. And also, for those who want to experience something similar to Stifle, they can obviously try out Lurking. So where can they actually sort of, get more information about Lurking and also try it out from themselves?
Okay, so for Lurking, you can just go to our website, www.lurking-game.com. with Stifled, actually, we have like a short demo that people can play via Steam as well. So just go to www.stifledgame.com and there's a link to Steam, and then from there you can get the demo.
That was Justin Ng from Gatai Games talking about the company itself and also the brand new game that will be out soon, Stifled. Do check it out, especially if you are a member of the PlayStation VR. Next up, I will be talking to Lydia Ho and also Peng Yiwei from Kurechi. They are the makers of Post Night and a whole bunch of other games that have been hugely successful here in Malaysia and also around the world. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. BFM 89.9.
Bring forth money. BFM 89.9.
And we're back. This is Game Time. My name is Jeff Sandu. And early on, we were talking to Justin Ng of Gatai Games in Singapore, talking about Stifled, the brand new PlayStation VR game that will be out very soon. Now then, in the studio with me is Peng Yiwei, the founder and director of Kurechi, together with Lydia Ho, the creative director at Kurechi. And we're going to be talking about Post Night, which is the brand new game that has been launched by Kurechi itself. But before that, though, Kurechi is, you know, it's one of the most successful mobile gaming companies here in Malaysia. You know, it could possibly be around Southeast Asia as well. Some of the awards that you guys have won are absolutely fascinating. It started off with, you know, the humble award of the best casual game at the Creative Industry Awards in 2010 for Reachin' Pitchin', and then later on you actually got a whole bunch of awards for, you know, the Tiny Guardians winning the most popular game in 2016 Taipei Game Show Indie Games Awards, best game in show audience choice for Casual Connect Asia 2015, and then also the King's League Odyssey, which has won best game at IGF China 2014, best action game of 2013 at Armor Games, and also best strategy game at FG Ninja Awards in 2013. All these awards just showed how successful Kurechi has been so far in the mobile games industry. So let's rewind back the time in, you know, when Kurechi was just starting out. Tell me about that story briefly.
We started Kurechi back in 2009. It's actually when we just graduated from the One Academy, and we spotted this IPCC awards. Not awards. It's IPCC is like a grant competition. Uh-huh. It's a pitch. And we kind of like, maybe we can give it a try. So I started a team, and I get my classmate, so Leah, and also Zeyan. So three of us kind of like sit together and start like, each of us will have different strengths.
Right.
So I'm more into the design programming, Leah into design writing, and then Zeyan into the the art creation part to it.
And I'm sure all of y'all are gamers at heart, because it's a bit weird if none of you are here. Perhaps then, like, your first memory of like the first game you ever played, Yiwei?
For me, I would say Mario.
Mario.
Yes, yeah, it's back in the console time when like, it's like my cousin and all that, they're playing, and I'm so curious, and it's just hop on.
And this is on the Nintendo.
Yeah, the back end, like the cartridge where you have
the old ones.
Yeah, yes.
And Lydia, what about you?
I don't really remember, because I got to get in touch with the computer at a really young age. But my cousin also had his console, and then my friends also had their Game Boy, so I think it was just everything
just
in
there.
One go.
Wow. Alright. So let's talk about Reachin' Pitchin' was the first sort of game that Kurechi Studios developed, and it also actually won the best casual game at the Creative Industry Awards in 2010. What is it about awards like this that actually, does it actually help a company like Kurechi Studios to, you know, elevate your profile and to climb up the ranks and get people to know more about you guys? Or is it just more pressure on a company like Kurechi Studios when you win, you know, these kind of smaller awards?
For us, like, there's two different sites. One is actually definitely to the internal one, which is for our team. It's definitely a great, like, recognitions and also motivations, because, like, back in 2009 or 10, when we were making on games, people were like, are you making games or are you playing games? So they have no idea or the concept of what is game development is like.
Yeah.
And back then, there's not the mobile game is not so common, so it's not everyone play games. So to get awards like that, basically, they don't know about games, but they know about awards. So you tell that whatever you've been doing is actually you have a recognition, and it does help in terms of like keeping us continue doing it. But if you talk about the in terms of the sales or the marketing or that, it actually doesn't help so much. But when you start to have more and more, it does help, because like it's more like your portfolios. Mm. And especially when you get out there, you talk to some publishers or you talk to some platform owners and all that. So they do not know who you are, but when they look at your portfolios, at least they know some of these awards, like it means something.
Mm. And Lydia, what was your experience like when, you know, being starting out as soon as all of you started just after college?
Yep.
And for you especially, because, you know, the gaming scene is dominated by just boys and men. But when, you know, you guys broke into the scene, how did that sort of change for you? And, you know, were people sort of surprised to see like, oh, wow, there is actually like a very strong female presence within Kurechi Studios itself, and you're obviously fronting it?
I think, like, if through the awards, like, because when we first started out, it was also like, kind of like, we were just trying, like, could we do games? So we just tried, and then we did a game. And then so to receive the award was sort of like a confirmation, like, you know, hey, we could do this. And when we do this, like, people can recognize it as a group effort. Like, maybe not individually, but when our ideas come together and all our efforts come together, it's something that we could continue doing. So in a way, it's a good motivation. Like, even when I tell my parents, oh, hey, I'm doing games, and they're like, do you earn? But then I can tell them, but hey, you know, our game got an award, and then they'll be like, okay, more chill. Okay, you can continue doing games.
It's just confidence building, I guess, with the parents as well. So, right. And also then you moved into solely a mobile focused in 2013. You released Go Go Night Mobile and also the King's League. And this was sort of adopted into the mobile platform. What was the decision behind, you know, this, you know, to go, let's just do full mobile gaming? Was it because the market was just exploding back then?
It's kind of like a trending back then, like especially when mobile markets start to, like, everyone's like, oh, mobile is a trend. And for us, it actually is a challenge, because what we have been doing is actually just some flash games that you play on browser platform and all that. Actually, when we're doing the transition to the mobile, is actually we have a lot of struggles. Like, myself is actually the programmers, but I am more towards the multimedia programmers where you do websites, all these flash content. So when we go into mobile, it's actually we really, really struggles. But going to mobile is something very different as well, because for us, like, previously we make games and then we generate revenue through our licensing and also our advertisings. But when we go into mobile, we go into like a paid, like a premium model where people have to pay to play our game. So the transition to it is, for us, is like that's totally different thing.
Yeah, very different business model and all in the operation as well.
And I don't know, when we make games on mobile, people start to see it as a game. But we are making game back then in the browser, people don't really see it as a game. They're more like a, like maybe like a play thing or things like that. So to us, it's the same thing, but towards the business side, like how the industry look at us, is actually very different as well.
And Lydia, what about your experience in the mobile scene? Were you familiar with, was it also a struggle, you know, this shift to mobile in 2013?
I think for us all also, the design was a really hard transition, because we were so used to, even when we were young, we were playing computer games, console games, so we were really used to controls for computers or consoles. And then the mobile market was emerging then, so like experiences on mobile, how players would want to control certain things or have certain feedback on mobile, all those were totally different. So we had to really, like, we had to look into it and also see what was the best way to design a game that was good in that sense also.
How difficult was it then to change, you know, you mentioned, Lydia, a great point there, when you play games on PC or console, you have, you know, controllers or joysticks or keyboards and mouse to do it, right? And you play games on a mobile phone, you're using the screen, which is also showing the game itself. So, you know, you are limited in terms of the amount of space you have for controls. When you're creating your games, how much of things were changed in order to fit the gamer on the mobile screen, because it's smaller, there's not much space, you could only, you know, do certain things compared to consoles. You've got crazy amount of buttons. Keyboards, you've got crazy amount of buttons. How's that challenge like?
When we started, we are actually only focused on in terms of the design, the visual and all that, because like when you do mouse, you can roll on things and then you have tooltips, like reading a lot of information and all that, but when you do in the touch screen, you can't have all that. So as we started, we actually struggled in terms of all these very technical things. Also, in terms of the memory of the phones have like back then they have really limited RAM and all that, so we have to squeeze in like
there's so many different versions of phones and Androids is massive, right?
So that's a challenge. But until now, as we develop, it's actually start to change, and we have to learn like the behavior is actually very different as well. People, when they sit in front of a computer, when they just play, they know they are playing games, they're going to spend a long time doing it. So compared to people who actually play on the phone, they can just turn off anytime. So the way that we design game have to cope with their behavior as well, because like when we started making King's League, a lot of people playing halfway and their phone rang, and then they answer the phone, and then we go away, the game's crashed. So
or
the game doesn't resume. So that's something that we never anticipate. And but now as we do, and then now we actually start to concern. So if you're making a mobile game, there has to be something special about mobile. When you're making a desktop game, you can do something more daring or something, have longer sessions and so on.
Did you guys get like a lot of hate emails from players at the early stages when, you know, their games were crashing halfway through, and you know, this is like, oopsie.
I think it was okay then, actually.
It's controlled.
We actually got like some really nice and encouraging comments back then when we started out, even from browser moving on to mobile.
And then also Tiny Guardians was released only last year, but it's also actually got a lot of feedback, basically good feedback. It's won the most popular game for the 2016 Taipei Game Show Indie Games Awards. It won the best game in show audience choice for Casual Connect Asia 2015 Indie Prize Awards. What is it about Kurechi Studios and the games that you create that has actually made a presence not just here in Malaysia, not just in Southeast Asia, but you are actually making a presence in the worldwide mobile gaming space? What is unique about all these games that you're making and people are standing up and taking notice?
I would say it like when we start making games, actually we don't set as in like all we're going to release the game in Malaysia or in Asia. So when I'm making games, we actually know that we have to compete in global market, because the moment you release the games, actually you have to stand beside Angry Birds and all these big titles. Like when we release Tiny Guardians, we're actually having at the same week as a Halo just released a mobile version, so we are just sitting beside all them. So you never know what will happen. So so when we do, we make sure the qualities actually can compete internationally, not just like having the mindset, oh, we are Malaysian and we just make game for our country and all that. So the mindset is actually very different. We actually set up like, we see how people do, and then we make sure that we have like what they have, and then make sure we have something unique as well.
All right.
So we know our strength that it's not in terms of like the 3D graphics or like all this highly advanced technology. So we go towards like what our strengths are, which is the art and the creative contents and all that. So we kind of like go from different angle to tackle.
And your biggest success to date is the King's League Odyssey. That again, like I mentioned, you know, it's won best game in IGF China 2014. A whole bunch of awards it has won. What is special about this game? Before we move on to Post Night, which is your newest game, but the King's League. What made this the biggest success for Kurechi?
I think because King's League, before Odyssey, there was King's League, the first King's League. So that was on Kongregate and a few other web game portal. So back then it was free. So from there we had a quite decent player base as well. So a lot of people knew about King's League before we even released it on mobile. And then of course when we released the mobile version, there was a lot of updates. We improved the entire gameplay experience, the art, and even the technology behind it. So when it was released, it was easier for people to pick it up. And then also to add on for just now, I think one of the things we try to do as well is to just make our games really unique in our own sense. Like, even if we're doing something in the same genre, we want it to be slightly different from other games. Like, instead of, like, some people will come to us, hey, why aren't you making a clone of that game? Yeah, so we don't do that. We want to have a Kurechi touch to our game. So I guess that really helped the player base from before. And then the uniqueness of the gameplay also helped King's League.
You mentioned clone games. We see a lot of games that became successful and had a lot of clones. Had anyone actually cloned any Kurechi games so far? Did you found online any games that are so similar in terms of storyline and progression-wise? Were there many clones of Kurechi games?
Actually, there is. Like, there's one point where we are actually having a booth in Casual Connect, and the developer beside us actually gave a very similar game mechanic. So when we talk about it, the battle system is actually quite similar.
Right.
So,
okay.
But they have their own thoughts and their design towards it, because like I would say, when you make games, it's hard to create something totally original because like gamers like something and then they want to find something similar. As well. So you have to make it unique. So we think it as not really like clone, but more like we inspired people to create something.
Right.
And but definitely we like Kings League, we have something like the pirated one. So basically they localize into their own language and all that. And I try to download it and play it. It's actually quite impressive. They're not just like simply changing stuff.
Yeah.
They actually do it properly. They have a forum discussing like, oh, so this unit, so how do we name it in our language and all that.
It's nice that you actually look at it as a compliment to your own success that you had. I'm speaking to Peng Yiwei and also Lydia Ho, and they are from Kurechi, and we'll be right back and we will talk about Post Night, which is their latest game that you can download now on your smartphone. We'll be right back. BFM 89.9.
Business, finance and more. BFM 89.9.
And we're back. This is Game Time. My name is Jeff Sando, together with Peng Yiwei, the founder and director of Kurechi, together with Lydia Ho, the creative director at Kurechi. And early on, we talked about the progression you've had so far with Reach and Pitch In, and then you've obviously had GoGo Knight Mobile, then the Kings League and Kings League Odyssey, Tiny Guardians. And now we've come to Post Night. It is your latest launch, your latest game. So tell me about this game. What makes this unique? And is this like a follow-up to, you know, the Kings League Odyssey or Tiny Guardians? Or something? Is there a back end story to this?
Okay, so when we started, we wanted to do a mobile game that was free, because prior to this, all our games were paid games. So we wanted to try to do something new as well. And then from there, we had this concept of because as you can see, most of our games are set in this medieval fantasy setting. So the same there, we have a knight, but we wanted to make the knight a special knight. So we came up with this idea of it being a postman but knight, hence Post Knight. So in the game, the knight does medieval deliveries, but instead of like normal letters and parcel deliveries, he gets to deliver more special and dangerous items. And yeah, so from there on, the game
came. There is an adventure to the game in a sense.
Yes.
So it's still a platform-based game, and it still has that same similar look and feel compared to previous Kurechi games. Or is this something where, you know, you've gone crazy in terms of the design side and the visual side of the game?
There are a few things that change compared to our previous game. First thing is actually the business model. So we used to create a lot of premium contents with premium experience. Now we go towards a freemium, which is free to play. And we actually changed the way that you play the game, because all our game previously, you actually play in landscape mode, which means you use two hands to hold the device and play it. But in Post Night, it's actually you can actually hold it in one hand and you play it.
So it goes back to the user behavior of could just get in and out of the game.
That is when I traveled in Tokyo. So in the metro, I saw a lot of people actually, they're holding their phone one hand, and then they have to hold their parcel or their bags and all that. And they play. And they are very polite when someone came in and all that. They have to move. So they put out the phone and then move, and then they continue playing the game. So I think like maybe we can do something like that as well.
Right.
So that's actually changed a lot. And the art style, actually, we changed a bit as well, because we have to do a bit of breakthrough in terms of technical. In Post Night, we wanted the characters to you can customize characters with different armors and all that. I want it to be reflect on your characters. Like, for example, you have this new cool gear and you equip it. We want the player to be able to see it directly. So to in order to do that, we can't use a traditional way to animate our characters, so we have to change. So when we change, the art style have to change as well. So it's more like we upgrade the way that we do the art assets and all that, and it somehow affect the style a bit.
And I don't want to give away so much of the story of Post Night, but I'm guessing, like you mentioned, Lydia, it's a game that you play like a postman in, but he's a knight and he delivers special delivery stuff. Is there like then like a progression in terms of like there's a big boss that I will need to sort of, you know, encounter, and it's something that you don't want to give it too much away. You kind of want to tease people to download the game, but something that could get them to.
But yes, boss battle. So even though the focus was to give people this pocket-sized adventure feeling, we also wanted to have the highlights of RPG games inside. So, you know, character progression, and also, of course, boss fights are a must in RPGs. So yes, we definitely put that, like, we have different boss fights, even though it's in a way limited because it's on mobile, but we did make every boss fight to be different from each other.
All right. And this is a freemium game, so obviously people can play it for free and try to level up without spending any money, but if they do, they will then buy in certain packs. So how much of the business relies on people converting from, you know, after they download the free game and they like it and actually buying the items inside? What is the percentage or you're looking at in order to know, like, this game will actually be successful?
So there's this industry standard where it depends on genre, like, but I say the conversion people will talk about like 3%, right? If you manage to get 3% of a total download to actually convert to buy your content, so you basically are doing quite a good job. So for our games, actually, since it's our first premium title, we are not really up to the percentage yet, but we got a lot of comments like, oh, this game is so cool, like, they're so kind, like, I don't hit any paywall and all that. So I'm really enjoying the games, and finally we have like developers really like not trying squeezes and all that. So we're trying to do it because when we started making the games, we actually have the goal that we do not want to have the traditional monetization methods, because we as gamers, we play, we are tiring through all this, like the VIP system, like they force you to gacha up on to get certain armors and all that. So we don't have all those systems. So we're going to try a different approach. So we actually, our monetization methods is a combination of advertising and also the in-app purchases. So right. Players actually do not get forced to watch any ads or buy anything. So what we do is actually when they go to shops and all that, there's this refresh where like every 4 hours the shop content will refresh. So if you actually based on mobile behavior, you play and then maybe you put down dinner time, you put it up, it's actually refreshed. But if you are someone being impatient or you're actually looking forward to upgrade something or buy something, so what you can do is actually you either can pay a little bit of gems to get it instantly refreshed, or you can watch an ads and then the shop will refresh by itself. So it's actually We even get players writing in, saying, can you put in more ads? I want more so that I can always refresh and get new things and so on. Yeah.
We are stingy people here. You know, we want everything free nowadays, right? Yeah. So tell me about the story, because a lot of the games that you create always seems to have very different style and stories, although they have that similar feel into it. But, you know, the storytelling is very unique in a sense. How do you come up with, you know, a drawing board or a storyboard for the new games? Is there like a set flow, you know, we want to tackle themes around this area, or is it the sky is the limit and let's just brainstorm and see what we could do?
For our games, a few of them, like King's League, Tiny Guardians, and even Post Night, we actually have it in this setting, this world called Prism. So King's League is in there, Tiny Guardians is in there, and now Post Night too. So even though it's set in different areas of the world, we sort of keep to the same logic and setting. Yeah, but in terms of story, usually we find something that complements the gameplay. So if this game requires more dramatic storytelling, then we will try to go towards a more dramatic approach. And if it's supposed to be supporting the gameplay, to enhance the gameplay, then we will go towards that approach.
Right. Will we ever see one day, you know, a mashup of, you know, Post Night, King's League, Odyssey, and, you know, Tiny Guardians all into one where, you know, you sort of battle at them out and, you know, do crazy stuff? Because obviously you have followers for Tiny Guardians, you have followers for King's League. Yes. I'm sure you're now getting followers for Post Night as well. Well, is there anything in plans in the future to do a collaboration between all of these stories, popular stories?
Currently, it's a yes and no. So we don't have have a plan that make games that put all the characters together for
it's
now.
It's not Avengers plan line.
Yeah, yeah, maybe our universe is not matured enough. We don't have so many recognizable characters. So maybe after we start to have more of these kind of characters, people recognize them, then we can start to do. But for now, actually, we have a lot of crossover. Like, for example, you will actually start to see our new updates. You will start to see some of the Tiny Garden characters will get into Post Night. And then we will actually have our new games, which actually we actually have planned to bring in characters from Post Night
into that. Yeah. So it's in the works, right? So where can people download Post Night from?
So Post Night can be downloaded from iOS and Android, like Apple Store,
and it's free.
Play. Yeah, it's free. Yes.
And it's free. All right. And it's Post Night, as in POSTKNIGHT. That's Post Night. It's a postman in a knight's outfit. Lydia Ho and also Peng Yiwei, thank you so much for spending time with Game Time. We'll be right back with Richard Bradbury talking about Battlefield 1 updates. They shall not pass. BFM 89.9.
Balanced Frank Medium. BFM 89.9.
And we're back with Game Time, episode 29. And as I mentioned at the start of the show, Richard was actually busy playing Battlefield 1, They Shall Not Pass DLC. That's why I was doing a few interviews with Justin Ng of Gata Games and also the guys from Kurechi Studios. Mm. Now, Richard.
Yes, sir.
Over the last 2.5 days or so, we have been playing Battlefield 1 because they have released the new DLC.
Mm-hmm.
The first of four.
Correct.
They Shall Not Pass.
Yes.
Or the French would call it...
Il ne passons pas.
That is excellent for a British man. Great stuff.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Allons enfants de la patrie. Aux armes, citoyens. Entendez-vous dans les campagnes mugir ces féroces soldats. Ils ne passeront pas.
Richard, let's go through the notes first because it is a big update.
Huge, yes.
Even if you're not a premium member or a season pass holder, there are game changes into the vanilla maps or into just the general gameplay itself.
There are indeed.
There are indeed. But first, let's talk about the DLC. Four new maps, two immersive operations. The French army is now included.
Oui, oui.
We've got a new elite class, the Trench Raider.
Which is awesome.
Which is really awesome. So let's talk about the Trench Raider.
Okay. Melee-based character, essentially runs around with a big spiky club.
Mm-hmm.
It's a one-hit kill if he's in close combat.
He gets to swing his...
He does.
Yeah.
Also has a pistol as a secondary, carries a medical pack, has frag grenades and smoke grenades.
Wow, he sounds unbeatable.
Pretty much.
Have you managed to try?
Once.
Once?
Yes.
Right. For me, it just had like a line of people kind of like waiting to get into it.
Right.
So didn't try it.
I managed to get... hold of the character very briefly and then jumped into the trenches, and I think I got about 6 or 7 kills before somebody stabbed me in the back with a bayonet. As usual, the counter to any of the elite classes is to bayonet them.
Just bayonet one
instant
time.
One hit kill, yeah. Very great character, brilliant addition, and it changes things up entirely.
Yeah, and let's talk about the new assault tank.
Uh-huh.
So my initial impressions of the tank is, wow, this looks good, and this you know, feels very, very something that's been lacking in a way when it comes to the tanks, because we only used to have like the small tank, then there's a medium tank and the heavy tank, right?
Yeah.
Now you've got one assault tank.
Yeah.
Fairly new kind of layout in terms of the gunner seating arrangement. I find it a bit weird because it's one in the center, which is the driver, and you have one on the right, but the one on the left is kind of like at the back end of the tank, and then you've got one at the, you know, pointing backwards.
Depending on which variant of the tank that you want. I mean, the new tanks that they've introduced are only available to premium members. We should say that first.
Yep.
And there are three types. There is one that is just a basic assault lead tank, which has a quick repair function. You can throw a pigeon out of one of the windows and it will draw down an artillery strike on the tank that you are in. They have a gas-based tank, which for me is my new personal favorite.
You kind of like that.
Love it, yes. It has extra armor, a quick repair. You can emit gas. You throw gas all over the place. And the final one is a heavy standoff tank, which if you are tank hunting, is the one that you want. These tanks, though, in general, the new ones, tend to be kind of infantry-based stuff. So if you're looking to take out a lot of infantry in a tank, these are the ones that you want to use.
The only problem I have with this tank is that I feel it's kind of like on ice skating ring.
It is.
It's so weird to control.
The physics that they've used for it seems to be a little odd. You are right. I mean, if you are going in a straight line, it's perfectly fine. But if you need to turn
chances of toppling over
are very high. Yes.
Which is weird for a tank that wide and that long itself, right?
Correct, correct.
There's also a new behemoth, the supersized tank.
The Char 2C.
The Char 2C.
Sorry, right? The Char 2C.
Char 2C. Right. Yeah, we got to be all French for this
indeed,
thing, right?
Indeed, indeed.
I didn't manage to get onto the tank, but I did manage to get a glimpse of the tank when I walked out one of the doors and I saw...
Immediately died.
Immediately died. Like, wow, what is this machine?
Right.
Huge, huge tank.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it was just a lot of people trying to get onto the tank, and I didn't have many game time with the tank.
Okay.
Can't really say much besides that it looks like it moves really slow and completely redundant. I just look at it and
see, that's just one opinion, Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so far, the behemoths that we've had, they were kind of given to us as the idea that they can be game changers. You know, mm-hmm. they can turn around the tide of battle. I think this actual new one, if you have a decent tank driver, can actually do that. You can keep it alive for a considerable amount of time. It does a huge amount of damage, and it takes an awful lot to take it down. You've got to kind of get together as a squad and as a team to take the thing down.
Mm-hmm.
It's covered in armor, and it will obliterate anything that comes nearby. The new tanks, even, will just take one shot. One shot if it's taken a little bit of damage.
Yeah, so apparently it's one shot to a light tank or artillery truck and so forth, but two shots to a heavy tank. But even then, the first shot does about 80 damage or so.
It immediately disables you.
Basically, you're a sitting duck.
Yeah, and you know if you're in that behemoth, that there's going to be a whole bunch of assault players around you wanting to take you out. Yeah. So
let's talk about the four new maps, Verdun Heights, Fort de Vaux, and then Soissons, and also Rupture.
Okay.
So among all these four, we actually had a really good game. And let me say, it is just hard to get any game with this new DLC, which seems to be a problem. We're not sure why, but I think everyone who's probably had this premium pass would have been experiencing problems in getting a server, so I'm very sure everyone's going to have that same frustration. But we managed to get into one server that had all four of these maps, and we actually stuck through that whole server for all four maps.
Which is rare for us, actually.
We never actually do it, though. Right. We always leave after the second game or so, because people tend to run away, but I guess because the server is so hard to find, a lot of people decided to stay on to that server. Verdun Heights, for me, is the best one that I feel in terms of gameplay and how I love infantry-based style gameplay. Verdun Heights, for me, is the best.
I think it's one of my favorite new maps, definitely. It looks beautiful, first and foremost.
Mm.
It's literally like two uphill battles. You know, that's what it is. You're running up a hill shortly after the massive bombardment, artillery strike on Verdun, based on the World War I, obviously. As the game progresses, as the map progresses, the forest catches fire as you're getting up
there.
Yeah, you burn. But there's a lot of very up and close trench fighting going off, and you kind of either stuck in the trench or you're in no man's land. And if you're in no man's land, the chances of you getting picked off are very, very high.
And then there's also Fort de Vaux, which everyone initially thought it's going to be the next Operation Locker.
If you're a Battlefield 4 fan, you'll know exactly what we're talking about. Yes.
But it's actually a lot more better than Operation Locker, because it does have a large outside field, which is very open.
Yes.
But once you get inside, it's a maze.
It is a maze.
It's a maze. It's probably the hardest map for you to sort of memorize and sort of know your way around it. Because I spent a lot of time just walking to a dead end.
Yeah.
And I realized, why was this road even here in the first place?
You're not on your own, Jeff. You're not on your own. I think we've all done that so far. But I think, like you say, once you've got once you've memorized the map, I don't think it will be that difficult. And I think we'll start seeing those familiar choke points that we are so used to seeing.
And Soissons.
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 Yes. Mm. Interesting map. It is played...
it's a tank.
You don't like
map.
It. Right.
I hate it. It's just too many tanks.
Okay.
And
so I think it starts off with six tanks.
I play the scout most of the time.
Right. That's your problem.
It is just completely useless to play a scout in Soissons.
So essentially, it's played over two levels. You have a village down in the bottom of a valley, and then it rises up up a hill and then up to some.
It's very pretty, though. In
it's
terms
a beautiful
of the
map.
You get the sort of the field view, and you know you see the depths of the hills and so forth. Beautiful place. Yeah.
But as you say, it is essentially a vehicle based map, and that's what they wanted. Some people did want a vehicle based map, and this is what we've got. So
you asked it, you got it.
This is it. Either learn how to drive a tank, or learn how to fly a plane, or get your assault game up.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And Rupture is the other one. which I only had a very few. Only had one gameplay on Rupture. It's okay.
I think that's the prettiest of the maps.
Yeah,
to be honest,
the poppy fields.
The poppy fields. Yeah,
but it's only one side of the map, though. Initially, I thought by looking at the images, I thought it's going to be like
the whole thing,
a big area at least. Right. But it's actually just a very tiny area.
Yeah,
it does look pretty.
Yeah.
We didn't manage to try the new operations.
No, not yet.
We didn't manage to try that. We will try and get it, but the thing is, like we mentioned, getting servers.
It's not easy. It's not easy.
Yeah, and we've played actually on Conquest.
Yeah.
So take so far in terms of the new updates from the style that is brought on. Has it made you excited again about the the whole Battlefield 1? Let's not talk about the weapons yet, but just in terms of what it's provided in Conquest.
Yeah, I think it has
new maps.
Yeah, I think it has
refreshed feel.
Yeah, I now feel as though it feels a bit more fleshed out. The game feels a bit more fleshed out. Mm. If these maps were, and we've had this discussion before, but if these maps were put into full rotation for everybody, I think it would start bringing player numbers back to Battlefield 1. But as we know, we're seeing numbers split off. We're seeing a little bit of division amongst the the players. But for me, yeah, definitely. Mm. It's really got me excited.
And there's new melee weapons. There's the cogwheel club,
yes,
the nail knife, and also the trench fleur.
Yes, indeed.
Wow.
These are all new ones that are available if you do certain things, which again leads us to the
other issue. I bought this DLC though, Rich. Like, why should I, now invest more time to unlock something that only premium members can get because you've bought it? Kind of like I'm doing double work here.
Because they are giving you that invisible carrot for you to chase, Jeff. That's why they want you to keep
playing.
Because
then I will be staying on, playing on for the next 3-4 months. Correct. And then DLC 2 will be.
Correct. Like, oh. And then there'll be new things for you to unlock. And so you're constantly chasing.
And for vanilla players, if you don't have the premium pass, you're not going to experience these 4 maps, some of the new weapons, the new behemoths as well, and the new tanks. But you will experience a massive change in the gameplay. And let's start off first with the assault class, because a lot of the weapons in the assault class have been actually being buffed up. And it's now a lot more stable. It's just a lot more better.
Well, it depends. The Hellregal, for example, which I know is I love it, is a choice of many assault players, has actually been nerfed, meaning that the horizontal recoil is a lot more difficult to control. I don't like. See, look at you. You're grinning there in your little.
I just don't like playing the assault class.
You just don't like getting close to people.
Yeah,
that's your problem.
Antisocial.
Yes, but controllability seems to be a little bit better. Stability for some things like the Automatico seems a little bit better. The biggest kind of change is to the medic rifles. There's been some huge changes to those. They're a lot more stable now. If you noticed before, the kind of random deviation of your bullets, they'd be spreading all over the place.
They've terrible.
Tightened
this.
That a lot. So the medic rifles are a lot, they've made them a lot more playable now. I mean, the thing is about the medic class, if you are a Battlefield fan, you will know that in Battlefield 4, you could be an assault player and a medic, which made it incredibly overpowered, right? And what they've done with Battlefield 1 is they've kind of tried to balance it by giving you the ability to revive people and heal yourself and heal other people, which is already quite a strong thing. So they can't give you the best weapons, right? So this is why some of the medic class doesn't have some of the strongest weapons. However, as you said earlier on, there are some unlocks for the new weapons. One of them is, of course, a new medic rifle.
And we haven't got to the point where we could actually do a review of these new weapons, because we have to do some silly challenges before we could actually get to play these new weapons. We will hold ourselves before we give a review.
Yes, indeed.
The biggest change that we have been discussing for quite a number of hours now is the grenade system.
Yeah.
It's massively changed.
Yeah.
Is it for the good, though?
Well, it depends who you talk to. This is the thing about the Battlefield community. It can be split into what people will call the Battlefield veterans, which I think is a horrendous term, and a bit snobbish. But it means, people who have played other games other than Battlefield 1 or whatever, where if you play stuff like Call of Duty, you will know that once you've used your grenade, a few moments later, you have another free grenade.
Yep.
The mechanics behind Battlefield was much more on team play, that once you'd used your grenade, you had to find somebody who supplied you with another one.
It was slow.
And it was slow. Now, your grenades auto-replenish.
Yeah, so
in DICE's way, they have said this should cut down on grenade spam.
Really, though?
Official figures say that the deaths by grenade are down by 7%.
I still got a lot of kills from the grenade last night, and I was dying a lot of times from grenades as well.
Me too.
I felt it's the same.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's the same.
But not only have they changed the respawn time on the grenades, but they've also made two critical changes to smoke grenades,
yes,
and to incendiary grenades. I mean, these were grenades that you would smoke grenades you would get two of,
yeah,
and the mini grenades you would also get two of. You only get one of those now,
which is weird though. Yeah. Why? Because those two grenades are probably the least popular.
Agreed.
And you would probably want to even it out in terms of, you know, people using different types of grenades. Not everyone is just using a stick grenade or an impact grenade or an incendiary grenade.
Right.
I don't use the smoke grenade until you told me how great it is, and go like, wow, this actually does make sense. But then for them to sort of put it down to only one smoke grenade now and also one mini grenade.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
why would you do that for?
I suppose what they're trying to do is to make us play a little bit more tactically.
Yeah.
That, you know, you only use a grenade now as and when you should use a grenade. It's actually forcing you to make a decision, or it should do in theory. But you know as well as I do, you know, you see a guy, you panic, you throw a grenade, you hope it kills him, and if it doesn't, you shoot him with your gun.
Yeah.
That's how many people have
There's
played
also
it.
A slight decrease, but not as quick as I want it to in terms of the grenade's explosion. It's now 1 second.
Yeah.
In previously, it was slightly longer than that or something. So, well, you know, it's still not as perfect, but they are working on tweaks with the grenade system.
They are indeed, yeah.
Let's talk about planes, because the... I love flying attack planes or fighter planes, and my biggest enemy is the AAs,
right?
The anti-aircrafts. Yeah. Now they have been nerfed because it now only does 50% less damage.
Yeah.
On attack planes and 40% less damage on fighter planes.
Correct. Right. They've also got rid of the effect that when you would have been shot by an AA, it would make you bounce around and whatever.
Yes.
That's been nerfed as well, so that doesn't happen. The thing is, Jeff, you know as well as I do that if there is a skilled pilot on a map, they can dominate that game, right? And they can take out the AA because they know where they all are. Mm. And now you're just making it harder. So I have seen games where the top two players are clearly pilots, and they're going 75-1 or 75-0.
Yeah.
The balancing of the planes is not...
It's
good.
Already hard to sort of take down a plane if the plane is not coming directly at you.
Right.
If the plane is miles away, it's just so hard to get the plane down.
Right.
I feel that the nerf system should work if, like, the plane is directly at you, coming at you. But if it's at a distance, it should be able to have at least massive side damage or back damage. But at the front of it, higher damage. So something like that would probably help, because...
The only other counter is that you have a bunch of people with LMGs shooting. It works.
Yeah.
You know, you got to remember that World War I planes were made out of paper and cardboard. Well, wood and, you know, fiber.
So, they shall not pass the update. Is it worth the money that you have spent on buying the season pass, Rich?
If you are a Battlefield 1 fan... Yes.
Yes.
If you are a part of the franchise and you have done for a while, yes.
Mm.
And I think if you are thinking about buying Battlefield 1 for the first time, I would suggest investing in this DLC.
Yeah, definitely. Same here with me as well. I think it's worth the money.
Yeah.
It's worth if you haven't had any experience in Battlefield and you want to buy Battlefield, it's best that you just sort of save up a bit more and just get like the deluxe edition or the premium edition.
Yeah.
The one that comes with the season pass, because if they're going to do anything just as probably as, you know, this is I think about 60-70% of what they could do.
Mm.
I'm hoping that the next DLC will be out sooner, not another, 4 or 5 months down the road. This was slightly delayed.
Yeah.
The next one should come in a bit earlier, and if it does, it's worth the money.
Absolutely.
It's really good.
Absolutely.
Anyways, that's all the time we have for Game Time this week, and we will be back on the second week of April with more updates. If you missed any parts of the show, you can download the BFM.my podcast or on the iPhone app and also on Android. My name is Jeff Sandu, together with Richard Bradbury. Game Time, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.